Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
The little sing-song welcome that we love so well.
That's what I do now.
Yeah, I love it. It's a podcast about movies and wine, and for those of you who don't know shit about one or both topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. He's the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm your movie guy, and we're here to help you. Each episode, we sometimes pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves, or not. Last time, neither of us liked the wine or the movie.
But it was a good pair because they were both bad.
It was actually a pair, accidentally.
They were both unpleasant.
Mmm.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, why they work. Hopefully we find a pairing that works. Usually we don't. We're not likely to today.
Not really trying. Today we are on to part four of Jamie's Court of Master Sommeliers Curriculum Tasting Flight mini-series. Jamie, we have concluded the three whites that are part of the six-glass tasting that you will be subjected yourself to in 32 days from this recording.
Yes, indeed.
So I believe that leaves us with now red wines.
That's right. We're on to reds. So if you have not been following along, we've been doing a little tasting flight as though we were going through a CMS or a Court of Master Sommeliers exam, and sort of breaking down the things that I find valuable and also want to gripe about with the CMS curriculum. Today's wine is the first red of our flight. It is Jérôme Chazot Bourgogne Rouge 2019, available, if you're interested, from Crush Wine Company for $29.99.
Well, Jamie, you told me that this wine was balanced, warm, and refined.
I did, yes.
And I don't recall hearing those words before. I'm sure you typed it in a thing somewhere, and I never read it. as I have been doing with this miniseries, I'm mirroring what Jamie is doing. My face has a mirror to it, and I'm reflecting Jamie back to himself, which is his favorite.
That was a little reference from the movie.
Jamie's hitting the books. I'm hitting the books, or remembering that at one time I was supposed to hit the books, and thinking back to my time at undergrad at film school. So from my side of the miniseries, we are watching what I'm calling the film school classics. These are iconic and foundational works of the Western cinema canon that I saw several to many times in my film classes when I was at school. A number of years ago. Today's installment of the miniseries is Maya Darren's 1943 landmark of the American avant-garde. This is Meshes of the Afternoon. You can stream the movie on the Criterion channel, which is wonderful. Criterion doing great works. Right now they've got an erotic thrillers sidebar going on. They've got a David Lynch series going on. They still have their Michelle Yeoh kicks ass thing going on. There's all kinds of great curation over there. You can also get it on Canopy if you have a library card with a library that participates in Canopy streaming service. And it's like an art movie from 80 years ago. So there's all number of free streamable places where you can find it on the internet.
You can even stream it on Wikipedia.
You can.
It's right there.
Is that where you watched it? You watched it on Wikipedia?
For the second time. The first time was YubTub.
On YubTub, either version have the music?
No.
Because the movie originally was always presented without a score, and then in 59, I think, her then-husband wrote an original score that's, like, incredibly famous. This, like, very atonal, a lot of, like, Japanese-sounding drums in it. And that's the way that I had always seen it in school, probably because the professors thought the kids weren't going to, you know, they weren't going to watch a completely silent movie with no music to it.
Speaking as someone who watched it completely silent, I did struggle to pay attention without any sound.
For all 14 minutes of it. Oh, my goodness.
It was difficult, Scott. It was real tough.
The score is cool. The score is bonkers.
I'll have to, I guess, watch it again with the score.
I think so. So, Jamie, we have an email that I would like to read and perhaps discuss on the show.
It got buried in our inbox. I remember seeing it like months ago and then meaning to bring it up and then not. So sorry to sender of this email who shall be revealed.
Yeah, friend of the show, Ryan, who I was having dinner with last night, was like, hey, not to like start anything, but do you guys still check your email box? I'm like, yeah, in theory. Why? And he's like, oh, well, I sent an email. I'm like, oh, okay, we'll read it on tomorrow's recording. He's like, I sent it back in March.
Yep.
God damn it.
It was my bad, Wendy.
He was very concerned. Sorry, guy. He was very concerned that he was getting someone in trouble. I'm like, no, it's fine. So anyway, we have an email from Wendo, and I'm just going to read it right here, Jamie. We're putting you on the spot.
Yep.
Jamie and Scott, this message is not for me. I was listening to the Marketplace podcast a while back, and they had a segment on the non-alcoholic beer market. It's an industry I was surprised to learn is growing in popularity. Heineken even had a commercial during the Super Bowl for their non-alcoholic beer. The Super Bowl, he says, with an exclamation point. So during a listen, during your guys' fine podcast, I wondered if alcohol-free wine was a thing, and it is. And it isn't just Welch's grape juice or that delicious sparkling grape soda that they push around the holidays. And he has a little link here to liquor.com, the best non-alcoholic wines, which I may have actually read that article at one point. So I was wondering if y'all ever had any or had some good recommendations, or even your thoughts on the whole idea of non-alcoholic wine, maybe a pairing to an equivalent non-alcoholic movie, perhaps, whatever that means. Let me know on the pod. Sorry to bother you two at work. Love, Ryan. He's a good boy. I really like him a lot.
It was no bother. I just forgot, and I'm deeply sorry.
I apologize for Jamie as well. I'm not responsible for him, but, you know, I'm associated with him, and I'm very sorry, Wendy.
And I do have thoughts about non-alcoholic wine and beer.
Shocking. What are they? Lay them on us.
So I think that the non-alcoholic sector of the beverage industry is like super duper important, just like from an inclusivity standpoint. When people go out to restaurants, people who don't drink often feel left out, or, you know, they feel left out at bars, or they feel just, you know, with the culture around drinking being a thing that we do to meet up with people. People who don't drink can often feel slighted, and I don't like that. I don't think that that should be a thing. And so through my career, I've tried to have pretty robust non-alcoholic programs. I have not found a ton of non-alcoholic beer or wine that I find to be compelling. Non-alcoholic beer tends to be pretty, it just kind of tastes like, you know, Budweiser or Heineken or like macro lager, which is a thing that I enjoy. I find it to be pleasant and refreshing, but I don't find it to be compelling in like an intellectual way, like I would a Trappist ale or a really well-made IPA or a Goose or a Lambic or something like that. And similarly with wine, I think you don't get a lot of subtlety or interest or intrigue from just unfermented grape juice. There is one notable example that I think is pretty compelling, and it's one of the wines that's listed in the 10 best non-alcoholic wine article that is linked here, and it's the Leitz 120. It's non-alcoholic Riesling, and I think Riesling really lends itself well to being non-alcoholic because we kind of expect an amount of sweetness from it. And it's pretty well balanced with its acidity as well. And it expresses a thing, you know, it feels like it honestly tastes like Mosel Riesling, which is what it is. That's where it comes from. I've tasted some other unfermented Riesling from the Finger Lakes. That's not like bottled for anything like 120. But I think that is an area of opportunity. I think red wine, it's kind of a non-starter. Cause one of the things about red wine is, tannin extraction, which happens in the presence of alcohol. Like you start extracting tannins in a cold soak prior to fermentation, but really you get that, you get all of the things from the skin that make a red wine taste like red wine during and just after fermentation, in the presence of alcohol, because different things dissolve in alcohol or water, depending. And you don't have that problem with whites. Hmm. Those are the beginnings of my thoughts. I have a lot more, and I think that the non-alcoholic cocktail conversation gets a lot more interesting.
The mocktail, I believe they call it.
As with many things, in the cocktail world, including the word mixologist. I have a problem with the things that they call things.
I think mocktail is pretty fun. My child had a mocktail recently.
I saw a photograph of him drinking it.
Well, we took him to 5 Acres at Rockefeller Plaza per your recommendation, which went very well. Thank you. But the waiter was baffled by the presence of a child and was like, "We don't really have like juice or anything. Like we pointed to this like list of cocktails." I was about to be like, "I don't know, man. Like, you've got water. He can drink water. It's fine." but then he seemed pretty interested in this RNG mocktail.
Right.
The picture that I sent you of him making skeptical face over the rim of his coupe glass.
It's so good. It's such a skeptical face.
His orange mocktail. Yeah. It was tasty. All right. Well, if anybody else has any other questions or wants to put Jamie on the spot or see if he's going to be wrong-footed about something, or if you want all of my blistering hot takes about, I don't know, fucking any goddamn thing that we have yet to share takes about on the show, send us an email at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And that is where we are.
I do have a question for you, Scott, about regarding this email. What could possibly be a non-alcoholic movie?
I have no idea what that means. I don't know. Like my knee-jerk reaction is to just say like a Marvel movie, but I think that's wrong. Those are more like nutrition free. They're not alcohol free. Those are the
Bud Lights.
The Bud Lights or the Coors Lights, but that adds a whole political element to them now by associating those with it. And I don't want to do that. I'm not doing that. Besides, Disney's never going to go there. No, I don't know. Non-alcoholic movie, like,
yeah, it's kind of a
like
nothing.
The most boring, formless, like Talking Heads documentary, maybe, you know, like a History Channel documentary, which is barely a movie.
Sure.
Yeah.
But like, non-alcoholic drinks can be interesting and have form and.
Well, but then what's an alcoholic
movie?
We don't have time for this. I don't know how to define what is alcohol in a movie. I don't think there's an analog there. Like what's the thing that fucks you up? Because now it's like, well, now we have to find a comparable thing for like hallucinogens, you know? And we're not doing this. I'm not doing this right now. At another point, if you ever want to do a non-alcoholic wine miniseries, great. And then we can start to unpack this.
Then we can figure it out.
But this is all prologue and I don't care about this. Okay. Thank you, Wendy, but not today.
So Burgundy, we've got Burgundy in our Burgundy. Glass.
Now, Jamie, I'm going to stop you right here.
Uh-huh.
Anybody who's been following along with the miniseries knows that we have been gamifying the going through the CMS grid, and I have been prompting Jamie with all of the various things on the grid. Jamie has insisted that we do it that way because he wants to make sure for the audience's stance that we have an audience surrogate and that there's a rhythm and that there's a back and forth. And every single time it's made the process take way too long. And I have selflessly volunteered to just step back for a few minutes to let Jamie go through the grid.
This bit is very good, Scott.
And but he insists he wants me to be a participant, and I appreciate that. It's not normally his way, but I got to step back this time because it's taken too long. And I think you should just go through the grid and just talk to yourself about palate and nose and confirming and initial conclusions and conclusive conclusions and take it away.
I will do exactly that thing, and I'm sure that you won't interrupt me at all during the process.
I'm gonna mute myself right now. Ready? Here we go. No, I'm muted. I'm muting.
You're the co-host of this show. You can interrupt me. It's fine. Scott's muted. I like this.
No, I'm not. I hit the button again. So let's do it. Go
okay,
through the
grid. We're doing it. Okay. So once again, for anyone who has not been, you know, listening along, this is the CMS deductive tasting method. And I'm going to go through this wine as though I didn't know what the wine is. Sort of a pantomime because this isn't actually a blind tasting. But I was thinking maybe we'll get one blind wine for our final recording of this miniseries.
Do we not already have all the wines for this miniseries?
We have all the wines, but maybe I'll do like an actual blind.
You'll just do one. All right.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun.
Right. And they'll like, whoever gives me the blind will give you the answer and whatever.
Or I'll pick the wine.
Or you could pick the wine.
That seems like more fun.
especially since you don't know what testable is, and then I'd be forced to like include all of the wines of the world in my.
Oh, I don't care if it's testable. That
right. This is what I'm saying. That adds a whole other element to it.
Right. Okay. That's another thing.
So this wine.
Initiate.
Yep. Here we go. 4 minutes and 10 seconds on the clock.
We're counting.
This wine is a red wine. It is clear. It is, let's call it ruby, out to a watery rim, a little bit of salmon at the rim. Salmon color, not actual salmon fish, Scott. There is no evidence of gas or sediment. Tears are medium. On the nose, this wine is showing clean and youthful. It's quite fruit-driven, very much red fruit. We're in the, like, tart cranberry, tart strawberry, tart raspberry, all kind of, like, underripe and tart in their presentation. Maybe, like, a hint of blackberry towards the end there. But there's this beautiful florality to this wine. It's almost like violets. Yeah, like a purple flower. There's also like a deep potting soil, kind of aroma to this wine. And there's some vanilla and nutmeg indicating some new French oak. But what's really driving the bus here is the fruit. This like really high toned popping fruit on the palate. Ooh. On the palate, this wine is delicious. Scott's giving me skeptical face, just like his son.
Disagree. Please continue. You're on the clock.
It is dry. Confirming those really tart fruits, they even tighten up a little bit on the palate. It's like very, very tart, almost bitter cranberry juice. Tart strawberry, tart raspberry. That blackberry note is largely gone. Fruit still dominates the palate, as it did for the nose. There, that potting soil note still remains evident, and I'm still getting evidence of new French oak, both in the presentation of the tannins, and also noting some vanilla and nutmeg. Scott's making ugly, I don't like it face for everyone. It's an ugly face that he's making, uglier than his usual face.
Hey, this is my usual face. What are you talking about?
No,
I just walk around all the time going, oh.
Just sneering doing stanky cat face.
Hey, man, you got.
I got not a lot of time. I know. So the wine is dry. Acidity is medium plus. Tannins are medium plus. Alcohol is medium. This wine is quite complex. We'll call it a medium plus complexity with a long finish. I think that initial conclusion, this wine is in balance. Initial conclusion, this wine is an old world wine, coming from a moderate climate. I believe it's old world based on the, elevated acidity and the condition of the fruit. Possible varieties include, Pinot Noir, Gamay, Sangiovese from, Italy or France, in a 3 to 5 year age range. Final conclusion, I know that this wine is Pinot Noir coming from Burgundy.
Well, Jamie, you did it. You succeeded. Palate does not confirm nose, though, my friend. Palate does not confirm nose. Nose greatly enjoys this. Nose loves the fruit. It loves the florality. I also was detecting violets, little purple flowers. There's some of that vanilla. There's like, there's a sweet strawberry and cream thing going on.
I was so wrong about the alcohol, and it's definitely because I knew what this wine was. This is high alcohol. This is 14.5%.
Oh yeah. Palate not liking very much. There's a lot of tannic bite, not acid, but there's a bite, which I'm going to attribute to the tannin. And there's a bitterness, I guess, that's coming from the tannin as well, which palate is not enjoying. All the actual flavor notes I'm down with, but the textural thing, like way too much tannin, way too much back of throat bitter. And it's leaving me with this like awful aftertaste that's like, I don't know.
You don't like the aftertaste? I really like the aftertaste.
No, it's like the bitter, aftertaste of like, I don't know, like almonds or walnuts, like not the good taste, but the aftertaste, which I'm not caring for.
I'm focusing more on the fruit that is left on the finish, like that really pleasant, it almost turns into like ocean spray cranberry juice as the finish happens. No. I get you that like structurally this wine is more extreme. It's definitely higher in tannin and alcohol than I expected it to be. I think I also said medium tannin, which is just fucking false. This is medium plus, verging on high. 2019 was a hot, hot year, my friend. This is climate change at work.
Don't like, not good. Why? Climate change made it more tannin? Climate change makes more tannins? Because of heat?
So, yeah, if there's more heat, then the grapes develop further. And so it can develop extra sugar, but also thicker skins. You know, depending on the characteristics of the year.
I don't know.
It's quite tannic.
There's things I'm liking about it. You say it's dry. I would say off dry. Or
oh, no, this is dry. This is under 3 grams per liter residual. Well,
why
for
am
sure.
I detecting some sweetness, James?
Because you still haven't learned to separate sweet flavors of sweet things from the presence of sugar.
I mean, that's probably why.
Yeah.
I like the look of it, especially also in high the sunlight. And
a more
helpful
charitable
answer?
A more charitable answer to you.
Fuck you and your charitable answers. Wow. That's a fancy word for patronizing, but please continue.
I don't mean I'm charitable is not the word, but I do like to patronize you.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite activities. No, but alcohol, higher alcohol can actually be perceived as sweet. Like alcohol itself.
And this is a 14, a 14.5?
Yes.
Ooh, I'm seeing some tears here. I'm liking the tears. They are, what do we call them? Thick tears? Droopy yeah. tears?
Oh, I didn't do staining. I didn't talk about staining. And there is staining in the tears here, which like for a Burgundy Pinot Noir is kind of atypical. And that's owing to the hotness of this vintage.
I'm going to have some purple teeth after this glass, I'm imagining.
Yeah, probably.
What? I don't even know how to describe it. There is a watery quality to this. Not in terms of flavor, but like were you describing this in words that I wasn't listening to? Where like on the top of the glass, I can almost see like a skim that is clearer than the rest of it.
I said it had a watery rim.
Watery rim. That's what that means.
So there's less concentration of the anthocyanins or the color compound in the wine.
Yeah, it's translating to a flavor thing as well, where I feel like front of palate, not much flavor. Middle and back of palate, more flavor. Are those connected? The watery rim and what I'm perceiving as lack of flavor on front of palate?
There for sure, plenty of wines that are low in color are extremely dense flavor-wise. And I would say that this is pretty dense flavor-wise. I don't know why you're getting like a front palate absence of flavor, because I get that's where the fruit starts for me, and it doesn't really end, which is why I call this wine so fruit dominant. Like right in the front palate is that like cranberry pop, and it starts pretty bitter and then sort of expands as the experience happens into much more easy to digest, I guess, like ocean spray, like cranberry juice cocktail thing on the finish.
I don't know. I'm trying to describe it in a linear way, but like in the beginning, it feels like just the surface. Like I'm just getting the wetness, and I'm not being facetious about dryness and sweetness. I mean, like I feel liquid, but not much flavor. And then as you know, I work it around in the mouth. That's when the flavor is coming at me. Ooh. I don't know, man. There's things I like in it. Loving the smell, loving the look. I like some of the fruit. I like the vanilla. Way too tannic. And then that bitter aftertaste, I am not grooving on. That said, it's high alcohol, and I find my defenses lowering with each passing sip. So, yeah.
It is also evolving with each sip. Like I can see that, see it changing, and the fruit is softening a little bit. I'm quite enjoying this. I'm sorry that you're not.
I appreciated the warning. Jamie gave me a rare, rare text message warning. Hey, you should probably open this bottle up before we record. So like 10 minutes before we hopped on the Zoom.
I sent that text 20 minutes prior.
And I didn't see it until 10 minutes prior. And so then I immediately went and opened the bottle. And I did a little bit of decanting. This glass is decanted.
So these wines have been open for over an hour now.
Actually not, because I stupidly put the cork back in my bottle. So I'm going to let it start airing out again. Just hope that I don't drunkenly knock the bottle over and permanently destroy this patch of carpet over here.
That would be pretty funny.
Not great. Not wonderful. I don't know. I don't know about this.
I think by the end of this episode, you will come around on it, if only because you'll be drunk.
What if I stop drinking now?
Well, then who knows? But I get it. I feel you. It is tannic.
Very tannic. Possibly too tannic.
I don't think it's too tannic. But I'm also a guy that really likes Nebbiolo, which is like the most tannic of grapes.
We've done a Nebbiolo on the show.
We have.
I think we did.
With Raw, I paired the Poderi Cola Lange Nebbiolo.
Raw.
Mm-hmm.
I like that movie.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. Don't remember if I liked that wine or not. I feel like I didn't because it was too tannic, would be my guess.
I think you liked that one.
I have no recollection of these things whatsoever. And my immediate assumption whenever this comes up is that my brain is just not wired through training and experience and exposure to retain these types of sense memory experiences.
Right.
But I'm a little bit worried that my relatively mild case of COVID last summer has just like fucked my memory. Like I'm very worried that I have COVID brain fog. And I just don't remember wine things. It could also be that I only drink them one time, don't really retain the information that well, and am drunk by the end of it, which, you know, also does like minor brain damage. And maybe the old short-term memories of the experience of the recording never actually makes its way to long-term memory.
Yeah, because you're kind of immediately going from recording the episode to like wrapping it all up and saving the files and getting it into the editing software. And
I guess, but then I also, like, I spend more time with the episodes than you do. Like, I spend a couple of hours editing each one. And yeah. So at the very least, I would hear repeatedly my opinions and my whining about the ones that I don't like. And I don't remember any of it.
Well,
I think I have brain dysfunction. I'm a little worried.
I've thought that about you for a long time, Scott.
And I can't even turn the tables because you know what you feel about the movies. If I asked you what you thought of A Town Called Panic, like you would have recall for that.
That movie whips.
I don't remember.
I want to watch that again. A Town Called Panic is fucking great.
Big fan. Huge fan.
That was fish in the barrel for me though. Like yeah. That.
God, I love that movie so much.
It's so much fun. Okay. Yeah. So wine.
Wine.
Get back to wine, right?
Yeah, so Jamie did it in 4 minutes and 10 seconds, the first of his three wines on the tasting flight. Would this be one of the ones, because you were saying last time that the California Sauvy Bobby that we drank,
you would have
schnoofed it right away and said, great, I can set this one aside because I can basically figure it all out from here because I know it's Sauvy Bobby and it's warm climate and therefore it can only be one thing. Would this be that, or would you have to do some noodling on this one if you were actually doing it blind?
So I would
That's a good question.
Huh? It's a very good question.
Very thoughtful question. I listen and pay attention and remember something, is that you say. And definitely I wasn't an episode you. That I was listening to this morning, just making sure I didn't fuck up the audio before I put it on the thing.
In my, you know, my first round of sniffing, what this wine would tell me is this is a red fruit dominant wine. And that's really what I'm going to get on the first round. I would maybe do a second sniff to assess if I get any pyrazines. Pyrazines are the green pepper, like vegetal kind of thing. And mm-hmm. that would maybe you know, if that was present along with all of this red fruit, that would lead me down a Cabernet Franc path. But in the absence of Pyrazines, my world is Pinot Noir, Gamay, Sangiovese, Nebbiolo. And so I have to narrow it down from there. It's not a layup, but I am pretty familiar with those wines, generally speaking. So I'm comfortable getting into it with a wine like this. Honestly, if I was blind tasting this wine at 14.5% alcohol with all of these fucking tannins, I would probably, I would struggle to not take it to Italy and think about Sangiovese and Nebbiolo. It doesn't have any of the volatile acidity that those things tend to present, but like this has pretty extreme structure. So I guess the answer to your question is...
No.
No. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Cool. 2 minutes later, no.
You're Thank welcome. You. You're welcome yes. for my thoughtful answer.
But I do agree that this is structurally extreme. Extreme. And structure is tannin, is acid, is...
Body.
Mouth, but body. I was going to say mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. Body. Those are structure.
Sugar, tannin, acid, body. Yes. Alcohol. And, sorry.
And then the other things are flavor.
Uh-huh.
And sugar is not flavor.
Correct.
Sugar is structure.
Right.
You people are completely insane to me. Okay. Fine. Please tell me about Burgundy. Is this our first Burgundy?
Let's consult the spreadsheet.
We've talked about Burgundy.
We've talked about Burgundy a lot.
You get up on your high horse about Burgundy a lot.
Because I get upset about Burgundy, man. We have had, let's see. We had Bodega Chakra Pinot Noir, which is Argentinian Pinot Noir, but made by a guy from Burgundy. So we talked about it significantly during that episode. Oh, we had, when we did Widows, the Domaine La Roche Bourgogne Blanc. So we had white Burgundy.
We had this white Burgundy.
Yes.
Because, right, because Burgundy is a place and not a type of wine. God damn it, France. Okay, and that was a Chardonnay.
Correct. And this right. is a Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, so our second Burgundy.
Our second Burgundy. Burgundy is super important, and it's a thing that wine people and wine educators and people who love wine talk about an awful fucking lot. And I'm a hypocrite because it pisses me off, but I also am going to my friend's house tonight to drink a bunch of Burgundy. So I'm a big fucking hypocrite, right? I love Burgundy, but I complain about Burgundy a lot. And the reason I love it is it's delicious. The reason I complain about it is the top end of it is like so incredibly fucking inaccessibly expensive. And I think that there are other wines that deliver this amount of pleasure that don't cost as much. And I think that, you know, I've said, you know, the phrase, the Court of Master Sommeliers centers this thing. And I find that problematic a lot. They center Burgundy. And I find that problematic. Like it's important and we should learn about it. It's the reason why a lot of winemakers over the years have hung their hat on Pinot Noir in other regions. Like the reason why Russian River Valley is planted to Pinot Noir is because there was a generation of wine growers who loved drinking Burgundy and that was their model for great wine. Similarly, Central Otago in New Zealand, there's a reason why Burgundy is important. The grape has probably been there in some form since the first century with the Roman Empire and has been cultivated there ever since. And the reason why we have such a granular breakdown of all of the different vineyard sites, like one vineyard in Burgundy can be less than an acre. And that is accepted to be different enough from its neighboring vineyards to put a different thing on the label. You label by vineyard in Burgundy, not this wine.
I understand what you just described, but I don't understand the significance of it. Is that
so? I'm getting there. So okay. the the reason why it's broken down like that and has been so like, has been studied at such a granular level is that there were monks working the land for hundreds of years. The Benedictine and Cistercian monks were basically all they were doing was praying and tending to the vines and making wine. And so over the centuries, they demarcated all of the important vineyards, and largely they were right. Like the wines from Genevrière in Meursault are better than they are in other places in the Côte d'Or or in wider Burgundy, just because of the aspect of the hill that they're on, or because of the particular slope, or the soil type. It was a place where the idea that a thing could be an expression of a place was the terroir, right?
Thank you. Thank you very much for, we have to say it. I'm not bleeping anymore, but we gotta get our pedantic T words in there from time to time.
Yes. Every now and then, was really explored. And it's one of the reasons why that concept exists.
Because of the monks and the fact that people have been growing Pinot Noir in this area for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So there has been time to study the differences between this hill and that hill, and that the plots and the vineyards can be so small because we've decided that this hill, this little tiny patch of land, is so much better for Pinot Noir than this one over here because of the air and the sun and the flow of sea spume and such.
That's right.
Okay. I'm with you. Good job. Please continue. I was struggling to hold on there to whatever the fuck you were talking about. So
You did a good job.
It's important for me to interrupt you and just summarize in my words what I think you just said. And it's usually a coin toss as to whether or not I have appropriately processed what you're describing.
Sometimes because I'm bad at describing it, and sometimes because you're bad at listening. Because Burgundy has been so well studied, and because these winemakers have generations upon generations upon generations of knowledge on how to make good Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, by the way, the wines tend to be very, very good. The problem is that they're also difficult to access, except at the very low end, at the like mass produced end. Like,
is this the low end? Because this is $25. This is not expensive, right?
It's $30, and I don't find it to be very expensive, but not a ton of it is made. Like, this is a small grower. It's not gonna be in every wine shop. The Bourgogne Rouge that is in every wine shop is Louis Jadot or Joseph Drouin, and those wines, they're fine. The problem for me is I love a small producer. I love seeking out the hidden gems, but and I've said it throughout this miniseries, as an organization that claims to be the example for global excellence in the beverage industry, maybe we don't need to double down on something that is already popular among the uber wealthy. Right? Maybe we can explore and place importance on newer things that could benefit from our centering of these things. Like if CMS started talking a lot more about, I don't know, pick a divisive one, Pinotage from South Africa, maybe more would be made at the high end and people's opinions of it would be better because there would be more money available to improve winemaking. There would be more interest in it. There would be more people talking about it. We know that Burgundy is great. So why is it important that it's such a huge part of our study? I think is my big issue. You know, we should know a lot about Burgundy because it is important to the history of wine and to so many winemakers and to me as a wine drinker. There's definitely more out there. There's definitely more things that can do what Burgundy does, that we can talk about. And we don't have to just be hyper-focused on this tiny piece of land in Eastern France.
Yeah, I'm ignorant of such matters, and you are the only opinionated wine person, or the only wine person I really know. So I have no counterpoint, and therefore I have no conclusion but to accept your conclusions. That all makes perfect sense to me. We should no longer center Burgundy for the rich, fancy people.
They're going to buy it and they're going to love it. And we should know about it for that reason. And also for context on all of the other things, but it's very extreme. It becomes all we talk about. It becomes this thing that we as Psalms like seek out because it's canonized and beatified as like the best that wine can possibly be. And I just don't think that that's true. That's what I've got to say about Burgundy.
I have a two-parter here for you.
Yeah.
One, let's say you get your wish and you become the powerful seat on the board of the CMS.
Yes.
And it's time to change what we're centering, and you get to knock Burgundy down a peg. Yeah. What do you replace it with? That's part one.
Well, it's not a replacement, right? It's just we still study Burgundy, just a little bit less intensively, and we study other things also. And I think one of those things is hybrid varieties the world over, and expanding out from just Vitis vinifera as the only thing that makes quote-unquote fine wine.
Vitis vinifera was grape. I thought that was grape.
Vitis vinifera is Pinot Noir. It's Chardonnay. It's Sylvaner. It's Cabernet Sauvignon. It's Chardonnay. It's all of the grapes that we know.
Right? That's the species of grape. You've been telling me that they're all Vitis vinifera.
The ones that you know are Vitis vinifera. Concord.
There's other grapes out there?
Concord is Vitis labrusca.
Should we be making wine from Concord grapes? Well, I mean, not, right?
The Mogan David Corporation and Manischewitz make plenty, and they make a ton of money. I've tasted some pretty good Concord wine. But more to the point, I think hybrid varieties, hybrids of Labrusca with vinifera, or hybrids of Riparia with vinifera are really compelling. And they're also much, much easier to farm. And therefore you can farm them sustainably without the extreme cost that you have farming vinifera sustainably.
Okay.
Varieties like Niagara and Cayuga and Delaware and a ton of others are, I think, necessarily the next step, because we need to find a way to not be spraying so much in vineyards, and we need to find a way to easily make these things in a responsible way.
All right. Well, that was my part one. Here's my part two. All right. You get your master pin. You somehow take a place in the leadership of the CMS community. Now, decades go by. You're a senior leader, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the creep of conservatism has taken you.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
What is Jamie's blistering hot wine take now that he thinks is revolutionary and iconoclastic that you will have difficulty letting go of after you are old and established and crusty and cemented in your ways? I guess I'm asking you to predict a trend. Like what are in 20 or 30 years, what are the new, you know, hot young wine revolutionaries going to be beefing about? And what is it going to be hard for you to let go of? What are you going to be on the wrong side of history of when you're an old man and there's new people trying to topple the king, you know?
I have no idea. I have no clue.
That's a good question.
It's a good question, and we could go a number of different ways. I mean, 20 to 30 years from now, maybe sommeliers will be discussing, I don't know, the whatever fruit we can possibly ferment in the wasteland that we have left for them. Is it cactus wine? Because that's the only thing that exists that we can ferment into alcohol.
We can ferment cactus water.
There's sugar. You can ferment it. It'll probably be a distillate because people are just going to want to get drunk, and it won't be about anything other than that. I don't know. I like to think that I move and evolve with the times, Scotty. I like to think that I'm good at assimilating new ideas.
Yeah. Well, you know who else said that? our parents' generation.
Yeah, they did.
I'm just saying, Jamie, all those motherfuckers who voted for Reagan, they had a great time at the summer of 69, okay? Hippies became yuppies. So what are we going to be in 20 to 30 years?
I think you and I are firmly out of danger of becoming that.
Okay. I'm
smash cut two.
I'm just reticent to, like, I feel that there is a thing with our generation where we're all like patting ourselves on the back and we're going to like break the patterns of whatever and that we're going to be better. I think about it most of all in terms of like parenting. But like, we're going to be better parents and we're going to be better citizens and we're going to be more responsible in how we vote and take care of the earth and spend money, and that we're not going to become intolerant of new viewpoints and new lifestyles. And I'm like, I don't know. What's the thing that my child is going to disown me over? You know, well, like, is it my child's going to come home and be like, hey, get dad, I got to like DNA graft. And like, now I'm part mountain lion. Like, is that the thing that is going to be a line in the sand? Like, I don't know. So I'm hesitant to think that we're just like somehow immune to this idea that like, not just political conservatism, but that a conservatism in general takes a hold as you get older, you know?
I mean,
one gets set in their ways.
For sure. And I've definitely seen myself slide into a less extreme form of my idealism or my leftism. But I still am, you know, basically a socialist. And I don't see any change in that happening. And I also have included new ideas into our thinking over time. So I think based on evidence, and we're also 38, we're not fucking young. Well, we're young compared to many, but we're like, this is around the time when our parents' generation said, you become conservative or whatever. And
it's morning in America.
It ain't fucking happening, man.
I don't know. I don't want to predict the future, Jamie, except to say that people can't predict the future and that some people think they can.
Duly noted. Sure.
All right. Well, if you're done talking about the wine and the story and the tale and the burgundy and the overrepresented centeration of it, then I guess we can move on. There was one thing I wanted to mention, which I nearly mentioned before, which is that friend of the show, Pri, looking out. She was like, I don't want to be critical. Like, so please take this in a constructive, like, I'm just a friend asking questions. She's like, but all of your Tim Tams have bothered me because you guys, she basically, without using that vocabulary, called out how our eye lines are not matching up, which I was like, Pri, you have no idea how validating it feels, because that's been driving me crazy. So basically the issue has been that you are always facing screen, your body is turned screen left.
Yeah.
But then you're turning your head this way.
Yep.
And I have tried different configurations of placement of monitor and camera to find some other way to do it. But essentially, we have both been showing the same sides of our faces and looking in the same direction, which is just terrible, like, continuity editing. And I really appreciated friend of the show Pri pointing that out. I'm trying today, so I am facing screen, what will be on screen as screen right, but I'm face body pointed this way, but then head turned back this way, so that we are both doing, I'm trying to mirror your general body posture.
Okay.
And we'll see how well that's working. We'll see how it works. I don't think anyone cares, but I care, and Pri cares.
Pri and you care. Those are 1.5 people.
Pri, Jamie, is Pri's
a whole person.
Oh, I thought you were, because she's short. Because she's small. She's very slight.
No, she's little. No, I just don't consider you to be a whole person.
That's not cool. That's super uncool. Wow.
One other thing before we get into Meshes of the Afternoon, and I did mean to mention this earlier. It's not about this wine specifically, but I know that a lot of people struggle shopping for wine. Because sometimes you don't know if the wine is any good. Wine labels are purposefully opaque and like difficult to read, and who knows what the fuck is going on. A thing that I recommend that people do generally with wines that are not domestic is to look on the back label for the importer. And if it's a wine that you like, the importer Generally speaking, great importers will import wines in a similar style. And
they have good taste. So Rosenthal, you endorse Rosenthal?
I very much endorse Neil Rosenthal. One of those importers that sort of shaped the industry as it is today. His tastes are largely my tastes. And so anytime I square up against a bottle that's got Rosenthal on the back, I usually will pull the trigger.
All right. Good product endorsement. A little consumer advocacy there.
Yes.
Rosenthal, Jamie endorses.
Definitely. The wines are good.
Well, I don't know. I'm warming up to this one. I've had the cork off the bottle for like 45 minutes now, and I don't know. Maybe it tastes different. Maybe I'm just drunk. I'm getting more of the fruit. Maybe my decanting previously was insufficient, because now that I just had more time to organically breathe, I'm liking it a little bit more.
I'm glad.
A little bit. All right. Well, we're moving on. So that's right. A little reminder for myself here.
You've got a Meshes background.
Bet your ass I do. Although I guess I'm just blocking her lovely face entirely.
Yes, you are. And
there she is. There's Maya. Maya Darren.
Looking beautiful and mysterious.
Very, very mysterious woman. Meshes of the afternoon. This is a 14-minute long black and white experimental dreamlike short. It was made in 1943 by Maya Darren and her then husband Sasha Hamid. And it's like a major work of the American avant-garde of the experimental film movement and of feminist cinema. It recently just climbed to number 16 on the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll, which even the BFI, who publishes the Sight and Sound Poll, acknowledged that is probably in part due to their recent efforts to expand the like voting base and to include more women in the critics that are polled. And like Maya Darren goes shooting her way up the chart.
Word.
Who knew? But yeah, it's a movie I saw a bunch of times in film school. Meshes is a dream narrative that follows a woman, unnamed, played by Darren herself, who has a brief encounter pursuing a robed figure down a sunny street. She returns to her apartment, she falls asleep, and then we watch her dream three successive iterations of that brief sequence of events, seeing the robed figure. In the dreams, the robed figure has a mirror for a face. She returns to the apartment, interacts with a series of loaded symbols like a key, a knife, a telephone, and a flower, and each iteration is more unreal than the last, before it all ends with her shattering her lover's face with the knife. The shards of his face fall away, revealing the ocean, and then seemingly out of the dream or after the dream, her lover returns to the apartment and finds her dead, pieces of the mirror sticking out of her bloodied body that is also draped in seaweed. Jamie, what are your thoughts of Meshes of the Afternoon?
So, as I mentioned earlier, I had some difficulty paying attention without any sound at all. The original version of this movie apparently had just screened silently.
Silently. No music at all. And this was during the sound era. Like, there could have been sound effects. There could have been a score or some kind of
accompaniment. But they deliberately did that.
That's right. I mean, they also made the movie for like $275. So,
which adjusted for inflation... Let's do that
real quick. Not much. All right, Jamie's going to Google and inflate $1,943 to $2,023.
$4,800.
$4,800. Yeah.
Hey, that's more money than we made our short for. I believe our budget was $2,500.
No, that's not true. We spent.
We also had a lot of free labor and
a lot of free labor.
Lot of free equipment.
Yeah.
So anyway, $4,800, not a lot of dollars to make a movie
money
with,
and not a lot of money for music. And yeah, the score was only added decades later. But the way Criterion has it in their little like note at the beginning is that this is presented in the original version of the film with no score.
So that was a barrier for my 2023 ADD riddled brain.
Your Tim Tam brain. You got a Tim Tam brain. Yeah. He's looking at the Tim Tams right now. I just saw it. He just looked off screen and his hand wasn't visible, but Jamie was grabbing for his phone and checking on the Tim Tams.
It wasn't the Tim Tams. All right. I got a text from a candidate.
It was Instagram.
No, it was not Instagram. It was a professional communication. Okay.
Was it someone you met on Instagram?
No.
Does this person have an Instagram?
Yes.
I rest my case.
No further questions.
Your Honor, I move to dismiss.
You're fucking out of order, all right?
So you struggled.
I struggled. I had to watch it two times. I watched it last night with a glass of wine, and then today again without any wine. And I like it. I don't know that I will return for it. It was interesting. There was a lot of like, I guess I didn't have the most pleasant experience watching it, but I found it interesting.
Yeah.
Is, I guess, the short version of that.
Yeah. I mean, Jamie, I might be surprising you here, but this is not a movie that like I watch once a year. Like I haven't seen it since school, but I also saw it a bunch of times in school.
Right.
You should watch it a third time in these 24 hours and watch it with the score. Because the score is like really wild and very cool. And I feel like whenever you see like, I don't know, like The Simpsons or anything that would ever make a joke about somebody making like an artsy fartsy avant-garde film, like they will reference Meshes of the Afternoon and they will reference the like the very like recognizable and like atonal score.
And the score was added in 1959. It was added in like
59, yeah, with her, I believe it was her second husband.
Okay.
Something Ito was his name. But yeah, they were together
16 years later.
Yeah, and he was a composer, and so they wrote a new score for like some kind of reissue or something. But yeah, it's I won't say that I'm like a huge fan, but it was one of those film school movies that I saw a bunch of times that I actually appreciated returning to, you know?
Right.
And I found that it grew on me every time I watched it, and that I found more things that I found compelling about it.
What image really stuck with me was the image of her falling asleep.
And then the camera tracks back through like a tunnel or a tube or something.
Well, it's her closing her eye. The specific
close up.
Yeah. And it's something about the just intense focus on an eye closing for sleep that I don't think I've ever seen before.
Interesting.
I found that image to be arresting.
The detail I picked up this time about that is I love that the eye closes, but then it's such a tight like close up, or it's not even a close up, like it's just an insert of her eye, but you can see the eye moving under the eyelid.
Yes.
Which was a very compelling and somewhat unsettling detail. It's extremely intimate. But yeah, I in school, I always liked coming back to it. It's provocative and the imagery is crazy. And the stuff that they do with the camera and the camera movement and the illusions that they create, I find all fascinating. It's a movie that was often compared and usually unfavorably to something like En Chien Andalou. Some of her critics at the time, most of the men, said that Darren was just being derivative of the Buñuel and Dalí film, which she pushed back against. I think, you know, as we discussed last time, that movie's like a lot of masturbatory, self-indulgent, fuck you bullshit. And this movie like actually has meaning. There's a quote I was reading in this MoMA essay about Darren. MoMA, who like refused to include it in a curation decades ago when it came out, and one of their curators trashed the movie at the time. Now, you know, the times have changed and people have come around. In this MoMA essay, they're quoting James Agee, but him writing for The Nation in 1946, called the film pretentious and arty. And he panned Darren's acting, which like, she's not a terrific actor. She's a great presence, but you know, she's more like a silent film actor. She looks great. And she's compelling on camera, and her moving is great, but maybe not what's happening up in here in the facial region.
Right.
But Darren's response I thought was fascinating. She said, whereas the surrealists go to great lengths to eliminate any conscious censorship from their creative effort, and not censorship in like, the government's telling you what you can't put in, but in the surrealists, like we talked about last time, Dalí and Buñuel as an example, took out any interpretation of the symbols, and they just presented the dream symbols as is and didn't probe beyond the depth of it. She says, I, on the contrary, impose as rigid a censorship as I can maintain, the censorship of form. The dramatic psychological inevitability must also be a cinematic inevitability, or the train will jump the tracks as most surrealistic fantasy does. You're burnt, Ancien Andalou.
Big burn. Huge burn. You need some aloe for that burn.
Yeah. But yeah, it's fucking great, man. I think it's trippy as hell. It's meaningful. The cascading series of unreal, if not surreal, but dreamlike imagery, like that every time we see her repeat the dream sequence of following this person who has picked up the flower off the ground and then going back to the apartment, and every time it's weirder and weirder in a different way. Like, yep. The one time she's trying to go up the staircase, and this is just like 1,000,000% where the Inception stair or the hallway, hotel hallway fight came from, where the hallway is rotating around and shit. And, you know, they spent like tens of millions of dollars to figure that out. And Maya and her husband, cinematographer, Sasha Hamid, they just, you know, they did what the Star Trek folks did like 20 years later, which is like, you shake this way and we'll move the camera this way. and that's it. They did it for like less than $300. Or when she's going up the stairs and it's like super slow motion and just like, yeah, like springy sprightliness. You know what I really love is that her shadow is a separate entity than she is.
Like, I didn't pick up on that.
There's a number of times, especially in whenever we see the bit outside the courtyard, which is like the actual apartment where the two of them live. Like, they filmed it in their own apartment and out on the street right outside. But when she's going for the flower, right, the opening image is this like mannequin's arm dropping a flower in the road and then picking it up. We don't see her until she sits down for the dream. In fact, we don't even see her face, I believe, until the first iteration of the dream.
It's and true.
So on the actual street, her shadow is what walks up first. And the shadow of the hand goes to pick up the flower. And only then does her actual hand enter the frame. And there's so many times when her shadow is the thing that we're following. And then separately, we'll cut back to see what the actual, like, Maya is doing in the shot. I think all of that is great and haunting. And look, I'm not, surprise audience, I'm not a psychiatrist. And I'm not a dream analyst here. So like, I can't tell you what all the symbolism is supposed to mean, but I find it all striking and it's super thought provoking.
It's one of those movies that you can, you can take a lot from it depending on your own personal perspective, right? Like it doesn't have to be what's denoted on the film. And also, as you say, the craft of it. What I did notice about her shadow was like, that must've been pretty complicated trying to get exactly the shot of the shadow followed by her hand.
Talented people.
Yeah. Using limited resources. And the stairway sequence. Limited. And the, like, you know, obviously the bit where they're like picking up the key and then the key reappears where it was. That's all relatively simple. Splice is what that is.
Yeah, we talked about that in the first episode of this miniseries when we did A Trip to the Moon, where the substitution splice.
Right.
You just cut, take prop out, don't move anything else in the frame, put other prop in, roll film. Like, yeah, she's pulling some of the old techniques from the wizard, from the master, Méliès. But like, Méliès used them for wizardry and trickery and to delight and confound audiences. Like, Darren is using it to like probe deep and talk about like what is the flower, what is the knife, why are the knife and the key seemingly so linked,
right? When the hand comes and picks up the key and it turns over and the hand is painted black,
mm-hmm,
and then the key turns into the knife.
Mm-hmm. Well, the key is that which gains entry. But then entry is a threat, and then the flower is life and beauty. But then the flower is also very seriously coded as a woman, or a woman's sexuality, or a woman's genitals. Like, the flower is in her lap when she begins to caress herself as she's falling asleep. It's loaded with imagery, and she studied poetry in college, and her father was a psychiatrist. So like, she has a great background in, you know, psychological, like, poetic imagery. And it's all just infused in there. And it's not just bullshit, fuck you, I'm Dali and Buñuel, fuck you, the bourgeoisie establishment.
Right, she actually has something to say, something to express.
She's got a real thing to say, and she can, like, articulate it. She went on to be a theorist after this. She wrote a bunch of essays, a couple of which I read in college, that were fairly significant about the form and about the meaning and about, like, what we should use film for, and she had very opinionated about documentary. And, like, that a lot of documentary was already pretty tedious to her, and that, like, why aren't we doing documentary that's more documenting something but bringing art and poetry and analysis into it instead of just trying to present something as though it's the objective real world, which is all horseshit anyway.
Right. Like Grizzly Man.
Yes, like Grizzly Man. Yeah. Great movie, big fan, great documentary. But, I mean, Grizzly Man's another one that interrogates the blurry line between, you know, what a documentary says it is, which is an objective presentation of the truth, and then maybe what it actually is.
Right.
Which is something else.
A thing with a point of view, the lens of a person.
Yeah. Big fan. And you can see the evidence of it, and you can see the impact of it, like, all over the place. Like, not only was she, like, an iconic woman filmmaker at a time when the number of women directing movies in this country had dramatically decreased after the silent era. Like, there were a lot of female filmmakers and directors in the silent era, and then that just dried up in a huge way in the 20s
because
and 30s.
Whenever men take power, they ruin things.
I mean, the men were already in power, but there were still women behind the camera, and then when the sound era came upon, like, women were basically just in administrative or editorial positions and not so much directing features. But even beyond that, like, as an independent, like, with this movie in particular, like, she was her own promoter. Like, she booked a theater in, I think it was in the West Village, and made up thousands of flyers and distributed them, and then sold out the show in, like, a couple of minutes, essentially, for a couple hundred seat theater. She took the film on tour on, like, the burgeoning art house scene, and she would give lectures along with the movie. She created a model for independent experimental filmmakers to, like, self-distribute and promote their movies that others have followed for decades. Stan Brakhage is who I think of when I think of experimental filmmakers. He was a collage filmmaker. Maybe we'll do a Brakhage by the end of the miniseries. And he pointed to Darren and said that, like, she was the mother of us all, of the entire American experimental and avant-garde movement. And then just, like, artistically, like, the image that's behind me right now of Maya Darren looking out the window with, like, the reflection of the trees and everything framed around her is one of the most iconic images in all of American cinema. And, like, if you just went to any website that talked about the American avant-garde, like, this image would be one of the first three things that you saw. Or just other imagery that, like, filmmakers have been mining out of this movie for years, like the mirrored face I've seen in a handful of places over the years. We already talked about the staircase sequence that others have stolen the craft of to put into more literal type of films and science fiction movies. But that imagery has been borrowed and exploited and mined. David Lynch's Lost Highway, his 1997 like dream horror movie with Bill Pullman and Patricia Arquette,
which I never saw,
has explicit references to Meshes of the Afternoon. Like, the tone of it feels like, what if we did Meshes, but, like, with more of a narrative? There's even, like, early on in the movie, Pullman is, or is it Arquette, is looking out on the street outside their apartment, and the geography of the street outside the apartment and the camera look from down here to pan up this way is, like, straight up a shot out of Meshes of the Afternoon. So, like, it's all over the place. And boy, you're going to love this, because this is, like, one of those classic stories where, like, she was a great artist. She made a huge impact. She made, like, 11 films, although after the first handful, like, none of them had the impact after that. And then she burnt out fucking fast with, like, a lot of prescription drugs. And she died in poverty at 44.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. 44 years old. She was 28 when she and Hammond made this movie.
And by 44, she was dead.
She was dead. Terrible. Ugh. Mega bummer.
Huge bummer. It sounds like she was kind of derided for this movie in the moment. Like, she made a huge impact, but people like James Agee, whatever, calling her pretentious and arty, were bucking against her style, but also I'm guessing there's a level of misogyny in there.
I just would imagine.
Sort of embedded in it.
So, yeah, definitely for
and
sure.
So you have this great artist who just gets slapped around and falls into drugs and alcohol, and that fucking blows. What's the alternate universe like where she was lauded for this effort and, you know, given more creative freedom or whatever, and, you know, more of a stage, and she was able to make more works like this?
I mean, she made more works like this. She made other films. She made another 10 movies after this one. And her essays and her writing and her film theory were pretty impactful. But like, there was never a world in which this was going to lead to like her getting major financing for anything, right? Like there is not a sure. market for this type of movie. Like, you know, this will play
then in, or now.
Right. It played in the nascent art houses, and it played at art schools and colleges and a handful of museums. And that was it. There's not a lot of money to be made in short form, dream, experimental avant-garde cinema.
Right.
So like, yeah, what's the alternate universe? Like, Maya Darren makes more movies, but like, it's not like Hollywood's ever going to come knocking, you know, she was never going to have great success doing work like this. And there, it's not to say that she was completely ignored or unappreciated in her time, but there was a lot of backlash, and yeah, a lot of it was men who were trashing her work, and not appreciating what she was actually doing in there.
What's up with her collaborator here? You said Sasha Hameed. I know that like in the credits for the movie, it's a, Hackenschmied.
Yeah.
He changed his name, or
they both changed their name. So Maya Darren is not her birth name. So she was born to Ukrainian intellectuals in 1917. And then they quickly got the fuck out of Russia after the pogrom started, and they came to the States, and she grew up here. He also changed his name. I believe he is of Czech origins. But so, yeah, he was a documentarian. She came out of a dance school, essentially. But she was like a real wunderkind, too. She entered the fifth grade at like age 8, and she was in university studying poetry by 16. And then very she cool. joined up with a dance troupe. She didn't want to dance, but she did a lot of like administrative work for this dance company that traveled the whole country. And then she meets up with him, and they hit it off, and they get married. And then within like a year, they made this movie together in their apartment. He was a documentarian. He had, you know, his own camera and his own lights, and he credits her as the one who, the entire creative inception of the movie came from her. And it was his technical knowledge that brought about some of the trickery and the trick shots and the effects that she wanted to create. And they worked together, I think, on her next 2 or 3 films, and then split up. And in fact, they split up, and they had like a third friend who they were all super tight with, who was another filmmaker, I believe. And then they split up, and then he ends up marrying that woman, and the two of them made a bunch of movies together instead. One of those. One of those weird little incestuous artistic love triangles.
Well, yeah. When your circle is small.
Yeah.
Bunch of intellectuals.
Isn't it bonkers that this movie came out during World War II?
Insane.
Like the look and the feel and the point of view of it, and even just her look, like she looks like she's like 20 years ahead of schedule, essentially, like the way that she dresses and her movement. It just doesn't feel like something from 1943. It feels very, very, very ahead of its time. And it seems like it was.
I will watch it exactly one more time with the score.
Watch it again. Watch it with the score by her. I believe second husband and collaborator, Teji Ito, which was the only way that I had ever seen it in school. I always saw it with the score, and it was only watching it for this episode that I heard it unscored. But the score is pretty bonkers, and there's some really interesting use of percussion in the mix there, and it adds something to it. I don't know that either version is better, but the score might kind of fill in some of the gaps that you were feeling in your attention span.
Just being silent for 14 minutes Not a thing that we do a lot these days.
It's pretty arresting, though, I gotta say. And I was watching it. I was watching it after bedtime, so I had the headphones on, and then I start the movie, and the Criterion tells me, you know, we're showing this in the original presentation without music. I'm like, oh, okay. And I go to take the headphones off, but then I had the noise canceling headphones on, right. And it was just like completely isolating, and I found it very enveloping. And kind of enthralling to just have everything tuned out and just to be glued into all the crazy imagery in this movie.
That sounds a lot better than like me listening to the sounds of the city and the trash collectors and the all of that. While
yeah, it feels like something is wrong as compared to this is the intended presentation.
Right.
Yeah. It feels like your TV is just accidentally on mute.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan. I really like this movie. Great imagery, great filmmaking. There's ideas in it that I'll never forget. I always come back to the scene after we've seen the three iterations of the dream, and then it's the three Mayas sitting around a table together with the key and then the knife in front of them, and then each one of them takes one of the keys, and there's kind of a standoff, and which one is going to murder the others, and you're waiting, and there's like this tension and this discomfort that comes about with it. Yeah, man, it lives in there. The imagery is up in there, in my mind space.
And then the black hand with the key, and then the knife, and also that bread. We didn't talk about the bread at all.
Well, what kind of bread do you think it is, Jamie? We're getting your interest back here. So is it what are we talking? Is it a rye? It looked like a rye. It looked like a rye.
Yeah.
You can tell from grainy 16mm black and white footage
It had a tight crumb. It didn't look like an artisanal sourdough loaf or something. You know, it looks like a rye. The crust looked rye-ish to me.
Okay. Well, let's get your friend Genevieve up in here and get an expert to weigh in on this 80-year-old loaf of bread and see what a baker thinks of it.
Absolutely. The pairing, is it a pair?
I don't think it's not a pairing. I don't think it's nothing. It definitely is not successful because there was no attempt, but like the movie is dry. The movie is tannic. The movie gives you some of the stone fruits, maybe some of that
airiness.
Yeah.
To it. And also there's a flower literally in the movie.
Yeah.
And we get florality.
I don't know. I don't think it's like a great pairing, but if I were to imagine like going back in time 80 years and going to like some fucking, you know, East Village loft where somebody is like projecting this on a sheet on a wall and they're passing around a bunch of wine and smoking cigarettes and everybody's talking about this movie. I can imagine this getting poured in the old glass.
Something like this, yeah. That was an evocative little tale you just told. An East Village apartment projected on a sheet.
Yeah.
I want to go there.
In 1943, where you and I definitely would be because you've got asthma and I would try and fake a 4F to get out of going to the fucking Pacific. I would probably fail at faking a 4F and then I would just get prosecuted and go to jail instead.
I'd visit you though, Scott.
No, you wouldn't.
I absolutely would. I'd bring you cigarettes.
And you'd be just hitting on Maya Darren. And
I wouldn't not hit on Maya Darren.
Yeah. Oh, the hair. I love the huge hair.
Just the intensity that she brings. It was a lot.
Yeah.
She's good.
Yeah. Do you think it pairs? Do you think this is anything? Do we have anything at all?
I was fully with you for your description of the like the screening room in the East Village in 1943.
You just like the scene that I said. Wine.
Yeah, I like the scene. I like
you just it. Like it because I said everybody's smoking cigarettes.
I would love a cigarette, Scott.
Your palate definitely has to be better now that you're not a smoker anymore, right?
Massively so. Yes.
Yeah. Would you pair wines with cigarettes? Are there wines that would be complemented by a Camel Blue or one of those yellow American Spirit boxes?
This is a path that we can't go down because I'm 8 years without a cigarette and every day is a danger that I have one. So like just thinking about pairing a wine with a cigarette is dangerous territory for me.
And you're afraid that if you have one, then you're going to open the floodgates, right? And yes, you'll never correct. Turn back.
I feel like it would be a slow, like if I allowed myself one,
yeah,
then I'd allow myself one the next week. Then I'd allow myself two the week after that. And it would slowly progress to what it was once was, which was a pack or more a day.
So Jamie, we're down three whites and a red. What's next? By my math, that would be another red.
Another red, yes.
How goes the curriculum? Where are we headed in the future?
Okay, so our next wine, we're getting a little bit fuller bodied. We're not going that far geographically. We're going to Saint-Joseph in the Rhone Valley. This is the 2019 Chave Saint-Joseph Offerus, and it is available at Crush Wine Co. That's crushwineco.com for $34.99.
Can we steer back in the $29.99 range? Because I liked that. I liked that. That was good.
Our last wine is $29.99.
All right. You're course correcting. Mm-hmm. That's great. You definitely planned it that way.
So this wine is a Syrah from the Northern Rhone Valley.
If memory serves, I like Syrah.
Generally speaking, you have liked Syrah.
K Syrah Syrah.
Generally speaking, you've liked Pinot Noir also. You just don't like this one for reasons.
Well, I'm warming up to it. Maybe my vigorous decanting before didn't do it enough favors. But this second glass that's been airing, I don't know. My defenses are lowered.
What movie are we watching, Scotty?
Well, next time, not at all paired with the 2019 Chave Saint-Joseph Offerus,
which I called Savory, Wild, and Big.
We will be pairing La Jetée. This is a film by Chris Marker. I'm not really going to tell you anything about it because I feel like you're going to get 90 seconds into this movie and text me and be like, what the fuck? But so it's La Jetée. It is a short film. It's just shy of 30 minutes long. It is French, and it's a science fiction film with a premise that, for spoily purposes, I'm not going to describe. But it's something that came up a bunch in the film schoolings. It's a landmark piece of the type of cinema that it is. I would say it's experimental in its own way, and it's fascinating. So check out La Jetée. It is, as of this recording, on the Criterion Channel, which I am, as always, a big fan of, and has a 14-day trial if you've never done it before. But y'all should check it out because it's super cool. And I'm very curious to hear what Jamie has to say about it.
I'm just based on the look on Scott's face, I'm excited to watch this movie.
You'll be down with the subject matter. The form is going to confuse you.
Okie dokie.
I'm pretty excited for this discussion.
Cool. We're going to drink Syrah and watch a French sci-fi movie.
La Jetée.
La Jetée.
Ah, oui.
Well, we have reached the end of our episode today, Scotty.
At long last.
Thank you, everyone.
Jamie to Hamey.
It's bad. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials, all of the socials. At Bigger Bottle Pod.
Jamie, email tell us. Them which socials.
We're on the Twitter.
We're on Twitter.
We're on the Facebook.
We're on Facebook.
We're on the Gram.
The Gram.
And we're on the Tim Tams.
Now we're on Tim Tams. You can see our dumb faces on the Tim Tams.
On the Tim Tams. We're also on the YubTub. And if you have questions, concerns, or international reviews you'd like read on the podcast, you can email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. And our art is by Ross Connard. Thank you so much, Ross. Also, special thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with social media and project management.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
That's all. I got nothing else.